You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cleus Jacobs.
And welcome to another edition of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Batgirl number 25, Batman number 53, Justice League number 6, and catching up with the Green Lanterns. We're going to talk Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 42 through 50, and Green Lanterns number 50 through 53. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC news. Posted a picture the other day of Stephen Amell's beard for season 7. I don't know how long he's supposed to have it, but
it looked pretty good. I'm not gonna lie. Yeah, I'm really excited to see it on screen.
Yeah, I liked it too. And if you guys haven't seen it, you can check out our Earth Station DCU Facebook group. I'll post a picture of it on there.
It's such a silly thing to think about, like, to be excited for, but, like, I'm not going to lie, I'm definitely excited for it.
Yeah, it may be silly, but they haven't really, you know, it's been 7 seasons, we really haven't seen it.
Yeah.
All right, and our next bit of DC news, this also has to do with Arrow. For the upcoming season, I guess it was so greedy that the CW's had to call in censors for it. So
I'm really curious what that scene is.
I know.
They didn't say that they had to cut that scene. So
yeah,
I feel like it's going to be something that we're going to see and be like, oh, yeah, okay, yep.
Yeah, so I'm curious about that too. I don't know if it's just a scene or more than one scene, or is it just going to be totally darker this season?
I feel like it seems like they're trying to go in a little bit of a Netflix-esque direction is kind of what I've been surmising from the stuff they've been talking about, which I think is right for Arrow. I mean, I would not want that for, I think, almost any of the other CW shows, maybe Black Lightning, but Arrow, I think, is that's the right tone for the show. That's where it really has worked best.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And I know that Green Arrow traditionally is a little bit more upbeat and kind of a snarky hero, but they kind of tried to do that in season 4. And I mean, granted, I think the writing wasn't very good, but it just didn't work. And I'd rather the show just go with what works for the show.
Yeah, I agree with you there. All right, and for our next bit of DC news, Supergirl replaces Star Trek actor with Babylonian 5 actor. Brent Spiner reportedly has been replaced in his recurring role of the unnamed vice president by Bruce Boxleitner. Actually, I've heard two different things. I've heard he's had a scheduling conflict, and I've also heard that he's had some sort of family issue.
Yeah, so I read that as well. What I'm curious about is, did he already start filming, and are they going to have to refilm those scenes?
I don't
know. Or are they just going to keep it and then switch the actor? I mean, like, to be honest, if nothing's aired, it seems like the opportune time to just redo those scenes. But then I have no idea, you know, what all of that would go into that either. So,
yeah, I don't know. I don't know. This news just came out today. So, and I was surprised by it when I saw it. So, whatever his reasons are, he's not going to be in it. So,
yeah, it was just kind of a bummer. I was definitely kind of looking forward to seeing.
Yeah, I was too.
On the show, so yeah.
All right, and for our last bit of DC news, and this also came out today too, they finally released some information about the CW crossover. Now, we had talked briefly about it this before, I think during Comic-Con. Found out that Legends wasn't supposed to be part of it. But what I thought was very weird is they're switching the schedule around. So it looks like the crossover is going to take place in December this year instead of November. The Flash is going to air on Sunday night at 8 o'clock, December 9th. So Arrow is going to be on Monday, December 10th at 8 p.m. And then Supergirl is going to be on Tuesday, December 11th at 8 p.m. So they're switching Supergirl, which is normally going to be on Sunday, is moving to Tuesday. And then they're moving The Flash to Sunday when it's on regularly Tuesday. It's just weird.
I'm really surprised that they're starting it on Sunday. You would think that they would just move Supergirl to Wednesday.
I don't know.
Start it, you know, just go Monday through. Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And maybe the big thing is they're trying to get Sunday night people to start watching on Sunday nights.
I have seen ads of them pushing the big, because it's going to be Supergirl and the Charmed reboot.
Yeah.
And they're pushing it as like a girl power hour. So, I mean, 2 hours, but, you know, it's like this, that's really how they're marketing it. So, I mean, I definitely get what they're trying to do. I'm surprised. I'm also surprised that they're changing technically which show is airing, because they must be doing it differently than they did last year, where it didn't really matter which show it technically was, because it was just one giant story.
Yeah, maybe they are doing it different. Maybe they're not. Who knows? There's got to be a reason why they're switching it around.
I can totally see why Flash would be first, because it's the easiest show to start a multi-dimensional story with. So I get that, but I'm kind of curious to see more details as to why specifically. Like last year, let's just say they were doing the same story they did last year this year, I don't think they would change the shows around, because it wouldn't really matter. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It wouldn't matter that episode one was technically a Supergirl episode, because it was just part one.
Right. So who knows what they're doing different this year? I guess we'll find out when it kicks off. We don't have, if it's called something, we don't know what it's called yet. Like last year, it had a title to it and stuff. Yeah. I'm really curious to get more information, and I'm sure they'll be releasing some soon. I'm betting they're not ready yet. Now, before we move on from DC News, I want to talk about this. I want to remind everybody about this fall's lineup. So this is the lineup coming up, which we've talked about before, but I just want to reiterate it. So The Flash is going to be kicking off things Tuesday, October 9th, with its Season 5 premiere at 8 p.m. And it's going to be followed by Season 2 of Black Lightning at 9 p.m. Supergirl will follow the next week on Sunday, October 14th at 8 p.m. with Arrow the next day on Monday, October 15th at 8 p.m. And then finally, Legends of Tomorrow will return on Monday, October 22nd at 9 p.m. So they're going to be scattered a little bit.
That's fairly par for the course, though, I would say, with these shows. They rarely all start at the same time.
I thought last year they started fairly close.
I think you're right, but that was, I think that's the first time I can remember that they all actually have coordinated that well.
Yeah, because they've always been staggered like it's going to be this year.
Yeah.
I have to agree with you on that. And maybe they lined it up because of the crossover last year. I don't know.
I have no idea.
I have no idea either. But that's what it is.
I can't wait. I have to say, I'm particularly excited for Arrow, just because I'm really curious to see what the show's tone looks like with a new showrunner. I really think it's going to be a pretty different. I know that she was already on the show working, but you know, it's different when you're the one that's actually like the controlling creative voice. So I'll be curious to see that. And I'm excited for all of them, but that's the one that I'm like anticipating the most.
I'm very excited about all of them and can't wait for October to get here.
I know. It's every time I see one of those ads pop up on CW, I'm like, oh man, it's too far away.
Yes, it is. All right. Well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
The Terminus Doctor Who podcast brings you passionate geekery that's often effusive, sometimes loquacious, but always full of love for the world of Doctor Who. Armed with a queer woman's perspective, you can look forward to the show covering both the new and classic series, as well as other forays into the so-called Hooniverse. So please check out the Terminus podcast for your dorky dose of deep discussion. all, of course, brought to you with a fun side. Because as the Fourth Doctor once said, there's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish sometimes. So head on over to Terminus.Libsyn.com to find the podcast. The Terminus Doctor Who Podcast. Queer, opinionated, Whovian, female.
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Batgirl number 25. All right, Cletus, when I saw Batgirl 25 coming up and saw that it was going to be about Barbara and Dick, I was like, oh, that looks interesting. Maybe we should talk about that before I read it. And then when I actually picked it up, I didn't realize it was an extra size anniversary issue.
Yeah, there was a lot more than I was expecting. When I honestly, when I started reading it for the podcast, I finished the first story. I was like, that was good. Oh, there's another one. It must be like a small backup story. And then it kept going. And then another story started. And I was like, oh, this was not what I thought I was getting into.
So we actually got four stories in this issue. So
I have to admit, the first one I thought was the best, and then the other ones were all kind of, they were fine, but I particularly enjoyed the first story of the four.
Yeah, that second story was really good. It tied into Batman number 48 through 50.
So we it have, really was. I was honestly surprised at how well it tied into those.
Yeah, I think it did a better tie-in than the actual Batgirl story they had. For the prelude to the wedding.
That's true. Yeah, that Riddler one was kind of odd.
Yeah, it was. So we have Batgirl revisiting the church where Batman, Catwoman, and the Joker had their confrontation after that wedding massacre. And what we find out was that Batgirl, if you remember from us reviewing, I think it was in Batman 48, where we had the groom praying in the church. And the Joker just comes up behind him and kills him. Shoots him.
Yes.
Batgirl ends up saving that guy earlier in the year. 10 months earlier, actually. And I thought that was an interesting twist. We find out he was a teacher. And he was helping save a group of kids from the Scarecrow. That was a nice tie-in. And Batgirl, I guess she... In the story, she was in a bad place, and she ends up talking with that groom whose name was Dwayne's mother, and kind of helped her realize how, even though, you know, he died 10 months later, that it wasn't in vain that she had saved him, and how he had important relationships and people who loved him. They got to spend more time with him because of her actions.
Yeah, that whole scene was really nice. And I also, I mean, the scene with the mom was really nice, but then this, like, the kind of summary of how she got there in the first place was really kind of heartbreaking. I mean, the scene itself with from the Batman issue was pretty awful to begin with. It wasn't like it was played for a cheap thrill, you know what I mean? Like, it was played out to be pretty terrible in the comic itself, and then this just really, really drove that home.
Yes, it did. Because in the Batman story, we didn't get any background on this guy. It was all focused on Batman, Catwoman, and Joker. Now, the second story, I like the second story too. Hopeless Romantic, where we get to see this, and this continues the wedding theme. So we have Dick and Barbara kind of hijack Bruce and Selena's unused honeymoon suite, and they basically just talk.
Was that a second story? See, because I think I probably just combined those two in my head. That's why I really enjoyed it. I thought it had a really nice arc where she kind of goes through this one thing and then needs to, like, talk it out with somebody, and she talks it out with Dick.
It was actually another story. And if you remember, I texted you earlier this week and asked you if we had a copy at the store.
Yes.
This was the reason. Because I couldn't tell where one story ended and one began. And I actually had to go Google some reviews on it to figure out that there was four different stories in this. I mean, some of them was obvious, and some of them just flowed together so well you couldn't tell it was a separate story.
Gotcha. Okay, I will admit I was the victim of that because I thought that these first two were just one really good story.
Now, it was written by the same writer, but it was illustrated. It was illustrated by two different people.
I did notice that, but to be honest, the other thing that clouds my judgment on that is because I was still reading it as if it was a normal issue and not paying attention. And so I just thought that the artist switched halfway through, which is not that uncommon between Marvel and DC. They both kind of do that from time to time.
Right, and it is not uncommon. And I did the same thing you did. It's when I got to the end and I was doing notes on it is when I realized, oh, these are different stories, because I noticed some titles during it, and I couldn't figure out at one point when one story ended and when the other began, and it was not clearly titled. It wasn't titled clearly in the issue, especially since I was reading it digitally. I thought you might be able to see it easier with a physical copy. That's why I asked you if we'd gotten it in at the bookstore.
Yeah.
But anyways, the first story is called The Reason, and the second one is called Hopeless Romantic. And both of the stories were written by Marguerite Scott, I think is how you pronounce her name. The Reason was penciled by Tom Derenick, and Hopeless Romantic was penciled by Dan Panosian. Sorry if I butchered names, but... you guys should know that about me by now. Now, I loved Hopeless Romantic too. It was great. Nothing really happens in it besides just talking. I mean, that's basically it. That's the story. But some of the things they talk about is important. I picked out a particular scene that I think kind of sums up that whole little story. So Babs says this: just a little time, that's all any of us get. We just have to decide what to do with it, who to spend it with when we have it. Take it seriously because it's a gift. And then Dick says, and do you see anyone in particular? And Bab says, I'm seeing him right now. And the story ends with them cuddling. It's great. I love that story. And I think it's a nice wrap-up to Barbara and Dick romance that's been weaved through both Nightwing and Batgirl. So I really enjoyed that story.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, the third story was called Value, and it was also written by Marguerite Scott. Now this one was penciled by Paul Pelletier. We've seen him do other stuff. I can't think of it off the top of my head, and I know I probably butchered his name too. So this story introduces a new 52 villain named Grotesque, and this villain was created by Gail Simone during the Batgirl Nightfall and Batgirl Wanted story arcs, which I have not read, but I'm from doing the little bit of research I did on this, I'm very interested in reading those. Now, are you familiar with this character at all?
Not even a little bit.
Okay. Apparently,
I read the run after Gail Simone, the one where they redid her costume that she's in currently. We're at the tail end of. That was where I read that Batgirl run, which is a lot more lighthearted in a sense. I mean it was definitely not like super peppy, but definitely a lot more so than the initial run.
Well, I have a feeling those two stories are, if any indication of what this story was, is a little darker Batgirl.
Yeah, no, it definitely was. Well, I mean, Yeah, the New 52 run, I know at some point is dealing with her brother, who's a murderer. So, I mean, it's pretty dark stuff.
I'm just kind of interested in what happened. So, this Grotesque was definitely a dark character in this story. And it looks like Marguerite Scott, she's going to be doing a story with this character in the future. Because she's, I think it said at the end of this little story.
To be continued.
Yeah, to be continued. So, and I thought, man, this is a dark character for Batgirl. But, of course, I hadn't read that other stuff before.
Mm-hmm.
We do find out that this story takes place 1 week later after the Dix Babs Honeymoon Suite story. So it's another continuation off of that. And when I first started reading this, I was like, because at first I thought Barbara was after an art thief, because that's what the story made it seem like. But then she comes across that murder, and I was like, man, that's kind of gruesome, because he kind of wrote his name in blood over the fireplace mantle. It's got me intrigued to find out more about this dude.
Yeah.
Then we get to the last story in this. It's called March Madness, and it's written by Paul Dini with artwork by, I'm going to butcher this name too, Emanuela Lapacino. But this story is it's totally different from the other three. The story centers around March Harriet, a sidekick of Mad Hatter. And we kind of get a nice backstory from her that explains her origin and how she came into the service of Mad Hatter. And then we find out that she's basically... Mad Hatter's in Arkham Asylum at the time the story's taking place. And she's basically there because of revenge. And I thought it was a pretty good story by Paul Dini.
I enjoyed it. You could definitely tell it was a Paul Dini story.
Yes. It was very much his style.
Yeah.
But
had that it's so funny. We probably talked about this on the podcast before, but his wife is a magician, and once you know that, his entire career makes so much sense, because he always manages to find a way to incorporate Zatanna, or if he doesn't, he has these characters that are very similar, and that was the case in this one too, where they had that very kind of same aesthetic going on.
Yes, it did. I thought this was a great anniversary issue, kind of to wrap up Rebirth of Batgirl so far, and to spin it off into the next part of its story.
I agree. I mean, I thought there was really... the stories were different, too, which is another thing I enjoyed, that you were getting different aspects of Batgirl's character. You weren't just getting four of kind of the same story. So I enjoyed that.
I did, too. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman number 53. So, we get the wrap-up to the court storyline. And in this, I was wondering what Bruce's plan was on this. But he pretty much explains how Batman is like God. And as a reader, we got a quick overview of Bruce's early life and how his father was a Christian. And that after the murder, he kind of decided not to believe in a higher deity. And we kind of get a quick overview of his training and the beginning of his mission. I like how they incorporated that in there in the beginning of the issue.
Yeah, I mean, and it really colors the whole issue too. I mean, the whole issue kind of is centered around that background.
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool.
And Bruce goes on to explain how the people of Gotham view Batman as a god. And they don't question his word or his actions because he has saved so many people. I mean, he even asked how many people had been affected by Batman in the courtroom. I think almost everyone raised their hand. Not in the courtroom, but in the deliberating room or whatever they call it. But anyways, he asked how many people, you know, had been affected by Batman, and almost all of them raised their hand. So I thought that was interesting. But Bruce, one of the things Bruce does is he reminds them that Batman is a man and can make mistakes. So I thought Bruce's presentation was really good.
It was. I will say, I was surprised that this story kind of ended without. I was expecting you to get more of a clear answer with Mr. Freeze than what we got.
Yeah, and I think they're going to explore that in a future issue.
Oh yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I was expecting this to. I don't know. It was. This story ended up being a little more incomplete than I thought it would be.
Now, were you surprised when Alfred mentioned that Bruce bribed his way onto the jury?
No. Not even a little bit.
So that I wasn't expecting that. I was like, oh yeah, that's interesting that he actually did. I thought he actually got. They had no. Tom King had me fooled. I thought he was
okay.
thought he had been summoned for jury duty. Not that he bribed his way on there, but that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And of course, we get the I think the funniest moment of this comic, and I love Alfred. Bruce goes, "I'm going out," and Alfred goes, "Oh, good. One feared you might rest another night and accidentally achieve some peace."
Yeah, seriously.
I freaking love Alfred.
Yeah. That was a pretty great line.
Yeah.
And then it ends, and we see he's in the original bat suit.
Yeah, I know. He asks Alfred to get out his original suit, and he basically says he doesn't want to wear the other suit because of Selina.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And we see him in the original suit, and Bruce admits that he's lost, and he needs to remember who he is. So, for reasons of changing costumes, this has been one of the best reasons I've seen.
Yeah.
Usually we just see a character switch costumes without any sort of explanation or anything.
Batman's always been a character that has made sense for him to change costumes just because of who he is. And he's just a guy, you know, with a lot of money. And so it always kind of made sense. Him and Iron Man, I thought, were always two characters that always really made sense for why their costumes change all the time, because that's just kind of who they are. But I agree with you that this one was like, yeah, this makes sense.
Exactly. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Justice League number 6. There was a lot going on in this issue.
It was almost a little bit too much going on, I thought. I kind of got lost at a certain point. I don't really understand totally what... I understand the ending, but I don't totally understand what happened, if that makes sense. And I know it's probably part of the idea is that we're not supposed to totally know what just happened. But I was pretty lost, I won't lie.
Yeah, I was a little lost too. And I'll get to more of that when we get towards the end of this issue. But one of the things that didn't make too much sense to me is it opens up with the Joker. And I know we've had some of the other issues kind of focus on villains at the beginning of the issue and kind of at the end of the issue. But the Joker one, it focused on the Joker, but I didn't think anything really became of it. You know what I mean?
I would agree with that. It didn't really seem to do a whole lot with it.
Yeah. I know we had some good ones with Lex, a focus on Lex, and a focus on Gorilla Grodd, and who else? Oh, Sinestro. But this Joker one, it wasn't as good.
Which is surprising, because Snyder wrote some really good Joker stuff not that long ago.
And maybe it's because there was just so much going on in this issue, he couldn't focus on the Joker.
I would agree with that. I want to say one thing I did enjoy in this is that I thought they were going to do the same thing that a lot of superhero comics do that drives me bonkers, is that they go out of their way to establish these impossible odds for the heroes and then have them win anyway. And I hate that. I was like, it's just come up with something else. Like, if you want them to win, make a believable scenario for them to win. And what I liked with this is that Snyder builds up how impossible the odds are for them to win, and then they don't, because they can't, because the odds are against them. Like, what should happen actually happens. I'm like, okay. It was a breath of fresh air. And also what I like to say, it seemed like the bad guys didn't really necessarily win either, but it wasn't because of something the good guys did. It was because the bad guys miscalculated something. I don't know. It was really nice, actually. It was like, wow, this was super refreshing, actually.
I have to tell you, the battle between Batman and Lex Luthor was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I like the use of the kryptonite ring, but ultimately, Lex Luthor ends up reaching that doorknob before Batman, who, I don't know, I'm not exactly sure how he did it, but he ends up sending Batman back to the Hall of Justice.
Yeah, that was when I started getting confused about what was going on.
So, and he's not the only one that got sent back there. Then we also see Flash and Gorilla Grodd. Seems like the Steel Force is more powerful than the Speed Force. And one of the things they figured out was Barry has to embrace the Steel Force, but I wasn't exactly sure what abilities it gave him.
That's what I wanted to ask, because I know they made a big deal about Barry slowing down and controlling the stuff, but I was like, I didn't understand, and maybe I just didn't read closely enough, because I will admit, my eyes started to glaze over a little bit. To what end? I didn't totally understand why he was doing it. I got like the general, he was doing it because that's what they needed to save the day, but I did not get what specifically that was.
Okay, you're not the only one, because when I read that, I didn't know what abilities it gave him to embrace the Steel Force.
Okay.
I don't know if we're going to see that in the next issue or what, but I was confused by that too. I'm like, okay, but what does the Steel Force do?
I might have to reread that then, because I was like, because they made a big deal. There's some pretty cool scenes with it where he's like getting super calm and in tune with the Steel Force. And I was like, this is cool, but what is it doing?
Now, likewise, we see John Stewart has decided to embrace the ultraviolet powers. And when he realized that Cyborg is not blocking the ultraviolet powers from affecting his mind, John kind of figures out he has control over them. But what was that? This is the other thing I didn't understand either. So John Stewart embraces the ultraviolet powers, but I'm not really sure what he does when he's connecting everybody on Earth to reveal the truth about whatever. See, that was confusing to me too.
The whole ending thing, this is where I started to get really confused, is that the heroes come together for this one final giant scheme to like save the day, and I didn't follow totally what it was that they were doing. And then you can see, so at the end, the White Lantern symbol pops up over the Earth, and it seems to have defended the Earth from the ultraviolet source at minimum. And you can see there's a couple scenes earlier where John Stewart is realizing what's about to happen. Like he can see that he says it's not a green light. Ultimately we realize it's because he's seeing the white light. I didn't understand. I got lost. I won't lie. I was like, I know essentially, like I followed the gist of what was going on, that they were saving the day, but I did not understand what they were doing.
Right. I hope they explain it better next issue. I was curious when I didn't recognize the symbol at first, and one of the boys was looking over my shoulder while I was reading it or something. They're like, that's the White Lantern symbol. I was like, oh, really? And I looked it up real quick. I was like, yes, that is the White Lantern symbol. Because I didn't recognize it exactly at first. I wasn't sure what it was. And then I was like, so does that mean the Earth has become a sentient White Lantern all of a sudden? I wasn't sure about that. Are we going to see the Earth battle Umbrex next issue?
I don't think so. It seemed almost something like it was life defending itself.
Could be. I was really curious about it, though.
It makes a ton of sense for the white light to be in this. Or I will say, like when I saw it pop up, I was like, I wasn't expecting that, but that makes a lot of sense. I totally get why you would include it in this story. I don't totally understand how we got there, and I know that part of that is intentional, but I also felt like part of it was not intentional. I felt like I wasn't meant to be quite as lost as I was.
All right. Well, hopefully they explain it better the next issue.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll be catching up with the Green Lanterns.
Hey there, folks. My name is JC Delatorre.
And I'm Rita Delatorre.
And we are Transmissions from Atlantis, an original member of the ESO network, and we are excited to tell you all about our podcast.
Well, it's everything science fiction, fantasy, horror.
And every single episode will have a segment of Doctor Who. Let's give everybody a taste.
I have my 2 minutes.
Yes.
Okay, then. So no interrupting.
Go ahead.
Fine.
You're using up your 2 minutes.
Shut up. You're interrupting me. Stop it.
You're now up to 50 seconds. This was worse than Kill the Moon.
It was not worse than
I would take the moon as an egg before I would take a bunch of trees, sprout up overnight, save the earth, and then magically... And where did the trees go? Where did the trees go? Yes. Transmissions from Atlantis.
Class.
Classy sci-fi pop culture discussions. Check us out, transmissionsfromatlantis.com.
And we're back! Let's talk catching up with the Green Lanterns. And we're gonna start off with Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 42 through 50. Because when I started reading it, when I got to the Green Lanterns, I realized this story was supposed to take place before that story. So We'll talk Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 42 through 50, and wrap this up and send Vendetti on his way. So, in issue 42, the story starts with the Dark Stars, and we basically see Hal Jordan conversing with Tomar Tu, which we've seen previously. He's in a science cell. He's there because when the Green Lanterns captured, I can't remember his name, but it was the Sinestro Corps member from his race, and Tomar Tu just ends up just killing him even though he surrendered, and of course he gets tried and convicted and put in a science cell. Well, anyways, it seems like Hal's been going and visiting him quite often. And while Hal's there, one of the Dark Star suits comes and basically breaks him out of prison and becomes the first Dark Star. And the whole thing about the Dark Stars is they use lethal force.
No trial or anything. They're just if you are a murderer, then you no longer have the right to live, as far as their philosophy is concerned.
Now, one thing I thought was interesting about the story was, and I don't know how many Dark Stars they brought in before, but Tomar Tu was obviously the leader of these Dark Stars. And they basically took control of the controllers and kind of linked their minds so that they could link all the Dark Stars together and coordinate their attacks and communicate. I thought that was pretty interesting. That the controllers weren't even in control.
Yeah. I have to say, one thing that I thought Venditti missed an opportunity on was that the Dark Star Corps, so to speak, never really managed to distinguish themselves in any way. Like, even Tomar Tu, it just looks like everybody else until the final fight where he pulls his helmet off and him and Hal are basically punching it out. But before that, they're all just kind of like the Manhunter. They're more like the Manhunters. And I feel like they would work better. This story would have worked better if they were more like the Sinestro Corps.
I agree with you. And I think one of the things about it was these Dark Star costumes. Now, we see in one of the issues that Guy Gardner lets a Dark Star costume take control of him.
But conveniently, you still see his face the whole time.
You know what? That's true. I didn't think about that.
It actually really bothered me. I know it's stupid. This is definitely a nitpick. Don't get me wrong. But like, everybody else, even Tomar too, they go out of their way to make them look as uniform as possible. But then Guy Gardner inexplicably shows his face the whole time. But to no real purpose. Like, I didn't even understand why. Like, we knew it was Guy Gardner the whole time. I don't know. That was weird. It was just weirdly unnecessarily inconsistent.
And honestly, I didn't even like the Guy Gardner getting the Dark Star costume in the first place.
That was a stupid plot line. I'm just going to throw that was such an unnecessary subplot that served no purpose.
I was getting ready to mention one purpose it did serve. It kind of showed how the Dark Star uniforms kind of took over their wearer's mind, I thought.
Yes.
And that's one of the things I wanted to mention was even when Tomar 2 gets out of the costume at the end of the story arc, he seemed to be under the influence of the suits also. The suits kind of had a sentient being of their own that I think the controllers were not expecting.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So it made them even more evil than I think they were supposed to be. Now, one of the things I did like, and I like the new Guardians, because they seem to keep getting involved in stuff when they need to be. Instead of staying in their citadel like they usually do, they're actually getting involved. Now, Venditti didn't do a very good job of showing them that much.
That was so weird. He made a big point of them actually coming out and fighting alongside their lanterns and then did nothing with it. I was like, that's a pretty big power boost that they just got.
And then they didn't do anything with them. And I thought that was a disservice to the Guardians. I do like the fact that the Guardians are back and that they're different. They're a little different from the previous Guardians.
Yeah. To me, taking this whole story into account, I thought it was decent. I thought it was a decent story, but I also thought it was a great kind of representation of Vendetti's run. For me personally, this is just my personal taste on it, is that he tries so hard to be like Johns's run, but he's just not good enough to do it. And so you get this story that feels like, you can tell there are definitely, it's the skeleton of a Geoff Johns story is here. Like, it has that sort of epic feel to it. And it has the same thing where, like, he pulls in different DC characters that you wouldn't expect, like Zod, the new gods pop in, you know what I mean? And some of the other things like that, it all felt very John's light, but not quite as good. You had this new sort of core, but they never really distinguished themselves enough to be interesting. You get a story that's 8 issues long and was probably only needed to be 4 issues long, because you get these weird tangents that ultimately do nothing. Like, the Guy Gardner bit was an unbelievable waste of space. Like, it came out of nowhere. I thought for a second, it was so inexplicable that he immediately was like, yes, make me a Dark Star. I thought it was part of the plan, to be honest. You know, I was like, oh, this is why he got Arkillo, because this is a plan. And I realized, like, oh no, this was just dumb.
I have to say, I never liked the Guy Gardner Arkillo thing. I guess I'm used to John's run where we have the Kilowog Arkillo rivalry.
Yeah.
And the Guy Gardner buddy with Arkillo, do not like it. Not a fan.
I mean, it worked okay with this story, but it was still like, it was such a weird sidetrack that took up a lot of space. Like, they could have easily, if you just cut that one storyline out, that cuts an issue out of this. And I get it. They must have been like, we need to end this at 50, and they just stretched it. But there are better ways to stretch the story than what they did, because ultimately it's truly one actual conflict. Like, there's sort of skirmishes, there's light skirmishes, and then there's one real fight and the Green Lanterns win. And so it never really, I don't know, I mean, you could kind of, even like with the Sinestro Corps War, yes, it was one war, right? But there was a lot of different engagements that happened there that were pivotal, like the battle between Mogo and the sentient sort of robot planet that Sinestro had. You had the battle on Earth. Like, you had different major engagements, whereas this was really just one fight that the Green Lanterns won. And so it sort of cheapens that. It never really feels like they were that big of a threat.
Yes. And the other thing I wanted to mention, another part of the issue that could have been cut out was they realized that there were so many Dark Stars, we have to bring in these villains to help us out with. And then you get to the last issue, they didn't really need these extra villains to fight alongside with them because Hal Jordan went to deactivated their central communication.
You could tell it was that same thing where Vendetti was trying to do that thing where he's pulling from other stories that he's been involved in and trying to make it a bigger DC story instead of just Green Lantern, but it didn't really work. And that was just, I don't know, the whole time I was reading this, I was like, this is exactly why you never really did it for me as a writer, is that he tried really hard with this, and it's just not as good.
It's not. All right, let's move on to the Green Lanterns, number 50 through 53. I am really enjoying this story, and it's not even over yet.
I was very intrigued by what was going on with the rings. I really liked how the idea of the rings not being your ally is such a cool idea for a Green Lantern story. I gotta say, though, I don't know that Cyborg Superman is the right villain for that, though.
I can understand why they brought Cyborg Superman in. He'd have the ability to affect the Green Lantern's technology.
I get it, but I feel like that's such a... To me, that the concept of the rings kind of betraying you is such a major concept that I feel like it has to have a Green Lantern villain that kind of matches that level of betrayal. So, like, to me, it would have to be like Krona or Sinestro or Volthoom. Like, to me, it would have to be one of those that has that sort of history with the Green Lantern Corps and has that sort of history of sort of almost being like the devil to the Green Lanterns. You know what I mean? That sort of tempter.
Yeah.
And then don't get me wrong. I know Cyborg Superman is definitely a major Green Lantern villain, both with Johns' run and the fact that he was involved in Emerald Twilight, and I like him as a villain. I'm very curious to see what they do with him, because I was a little bit disappointed when they revealed it was him.
I know where they're going with this because I've already read. I read about what they're going to be doing, and it has to do with Coast City. There's supposed to be a big battle in Coast City, and it has to do with Hal and Cyborg Superman, and it's going back to the first time where they battled. That's where the story's heading to.
That's kind of interesting, because then that goes into the kind of the tapping into that betrayal that Hal had. So, okay, so I can see that.
Now, you got to remember, who's writing this?
I don't remember.
It was Dan Jurgens. So,
Now,
does it make sense to you?
It does.
It ties back in, because he wrote the original story with the death of Superman and the return of Superman, all that stuff. That was his run. And he's tying this back into that with Hal and Cyborg Superman. So it makes sense. I'm wondering what Cyborg Superman's... they reveal him at the end, but we don't know what his goal is here. What is he trying to achieve?
Yeah.
Is it a revenge thing? Is it something else? It kind of feels like a revenge thing to me.
Oh, yeah.
I'm interested where this is going, and I'm very curious in them figuring out about the rings not working correctly, because we've been through 3 issues now. They still haven't realized it yet, especially Simon.
John is the only one, and he's unconscious, that knows that the ring is not to be trusted.
Yeah, that's true. Very, very good so far. I have to say...
I'm not going to lie, though. It makes sense that Jurgens is writing this, but I would love to see this concept explored by another writer. I'm just going to throw that out there. Like, I would love to see what Johns or King would do with a story where your Green Lantern ring can't be trusted.
Okay, you can't have Tom King and Jeff Johns writing everything, Cletus.
I know. I'm just saying. It's such a cool concept. I don't know.
It is a cool concept.
Just to have it go, see, to me, just to have it go back to Coast City feels like it's just Jurgens, like, hey, remember when I was relevant, guys? He's been on that nostalgia run for like 3 years now. Like, hey guys, remember when I was the big DC writer?
I have to say, he's drawn me into the story, though.
I am drawn into the story, but that does not seem like a natural conclusion to this story.
Why don't you not give judgment until you've read the whole story?
That's very fair. I will admit, I am not being fair to this story right now, but I'm like, I was really into the mystery, and then as soon as I saw it was Cyborg Superman, I was like, what?
See, I was surprised it was Cyborg Superman. I was like, oh, this is interesting. I was not expecting him.
I wasn't either.
So I thought it was a nice surprise because he was the last person I was expecting.
I will agree with that. I was not expecting
Sinestro, but I was expecting
some other... I didn't think it was Sinestro either. I thought it needed to be somebody along those lines of like a true nemesis to the Green Lantern Corps. And I would not personally put Cyborg Superman there.
No, but he has been a major villain in the past.
I agree with you. But I feel like he's specifically to Hal and not the Corps.
If you notice, Green Lanterns has been a focus on Simon and Jessica. While they're in this, this story is not really focusing on any one Green Lantern. It's encompassing the Corps as a whole.
You can tell. I could definitely tell that a different writer was writing it because I was like, this person is not focusing on Jessica and Baz.
Yeah. And, of course, we know this, we hadn't announced it because I hadn't heard anything, and I finally found out that this title is ending in October.
That makes sense.
So, it does make sense. I can't even remember who the other writer was on this, but apparently Jurgens is in the run. When Green Lanterns relaunches as whatever it's supposed to be, I think it's supposed to be called either Green Lantern or The Green Lantern or something like that. It's going to focus on Hal. And I have a feeling Jurgens is taking this storyline to where it's going to focus on Hal, you know, when the new writers come in.
I'm excited. I'm really excited for the new run because it's Grant Morrison, and I'm very, very excited to see what he does with Green Lantern.
I am too. We're going to get a refresh of Green Lantern or a new take on him, so I'm interested in seeing that. And I'm hoping we get some stories that become classics.
Me too. That's the big thing. That was not so much with this story, but with the Vendetti one, was you could feel it was trying really hard to be a classic Green Lantern story, and it just won't be. At least I don't think so.
I think they'll try
to initially pitch it as like the classic Green Lantern Dark Star series, but it won't. There's no staying power to that story.
No, I agree with you on that. All right, well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have any shout-outs, Cletus?
Yes, this one's a little bit of a different shout-out. I was at the board game store tonight, actually, and I did not know this game was coming out, so it was kind of cool. I went and looked it up a little bit. So there is a board game called Spyfall, and they actually have a spinoff that they just put out called DC Spyfall, and it's got the Joker as the villain, and I'll just read. So I'm just going to read a quick summary of this game. Based on the social party game Spyfall, DC Spyfall is an easy-to-learn party game that features bluffing, suspicion, probing questions, and clever answers. At the start of each round, players receive a secret card informing them of the group's location, such as like Arkham Asylum, the Daily Planet, Star Labs, except for one player who receives the Joker card instead. The Joker doesn't know where he is, but if he can figure out his location before his cover is blown, he wins the round.
That sounds interesting.
It sounds really cool, and it's like one of those really kind of fun party games that you can pull out with a group of people. I think it'd be pretty cool.
That does sound pretty cool. All right, and I'm going to shout out to my son, Jordan, because he was grounded from electronics and was looking for something to read. And I was like, why don't you take a look at my DC Giant 100s? Those don't look very interesting. I was like, well, why don't you try just reading one of them? Well, guess what? He's read all of them. Even after he got his electronics back. So he's already bugging me about, when's Batman number 2 going to come out? and Teen Titans number 2. So he's really into them. And I just think that's cool to see. He's getting that passion for comics.
That's awesome. That's really
just
cool.
From those titles. So I got to give a big shout out to DC for putting out those 100-page giants, because I just got to imagine they're bringing in other readers too. So don't normally read comics.
Yeah. I hope so. That was the whole plan.
Yep. All right. We got some mail here, Cletus. This is from Richard Ewell, the host and producer of the Nerdy Laser podcast, which is also on the ESO network. He's a co-host of the Pro Wrestling Roundtable, which is also on the ESO network. And he's also a co-host of the Assignment Horror podcast, which I've never heard of before. So that must be, that's a non-ESO show. But he writes, "Hey guys, I've been loving the podcast lately. Great stuff. Keep up the awesome work." Which I thought was pretty cool. And
that's very nice.
That is very nice. And he also sent us his list of his top 5 DC villains. So we're going to read them off here. Starting with number 5, Scarface. Number 4.
That's a cool one.
Yeah, that is a cool one. Number 4, Doomsday. Number 3, oh, what's that?
Nice. I'm just I'm the peanut gallery. I'm just enjoying the list.
Yeah, I'm not giving you enough space there to make comments. All right. Number 3, Clayface.
Cool one. Good choice.
Number 2, Bizarro.
Nice. I like Bizarro.
And number 1, Bane. And because he has Bane as his number 1, I got to guess that he's probably a big fan of the Nightfall story arc.
Oh yeah, one would assume. probably not the Batman and Robin one.
No, probably not from the movie. So, really appreciate you writing into us, Richard, and letting us know that you've been listening to the podcast. Sometimes it feels like nobody's listening out there.
And honestly, anybody else, if you want to pitch in your top 5 villains, we would love to read them on the podcast. It's super cool just to see, like, Scarface. Like that's such a cool Batman villain that I don't even remember sometimes. Like, that's awesome. We would love to hear them. So please, if you want to, please send us them.
Right. And the easiest way to send them to us is you can either call our feedback line at 317-564-9133 and leave us a message, or you can do like Richard did and email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, next week we're going to be talking Action Comics number 1002, Detective Comics number 987, Justice League Dark number 2, The Flash number 53, and The Terrifics number 7. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you next time.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
You're ready to move off.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.